Well, welcome back to another episode of the Andrew Luck Book Club podcast, the first one in 2018, and I am very, very excited and delighted to be joined by the most accomplished author of A Gentleman in Moscow, Mr. Amor Towles. How are you doing, sir? Thank you very much for joining me.
It's nice to be here, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you are in New York City, I think, right now. I'm on the West Coast, California, for the off season. It's amazing what technology can do for a podcast in Indianapolis. This is awesome.
Yeah, you should just tell people we're in the same room.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, we're in the same room, somewhere in the cloud.
Right. So,
A Gentleman in Moscow, I thought incredibly engrossing and uplifting novel set in a really unique setting, a hotel. The confines of a hotel with our protagonist, the Count Alexander Rostov, all set against the backdrop of a revolution, civil war, some purges, world wars, all in Russia. And I guess my first question about the book is, what was the genesis of it, and where did the idea come from?
Yeah, so I mean, I began writing fiction as a kid, and I wrote it in college. I wrote it in graduate school.
Yeah.
But I spent 20 years when I came to New York, first came to New York, in the investment business, and I would I would travel for the firm, and in that capacity, I would spend a week in any given year in a hotel in L.A., a hotel in London, a hotel in Chicago, and one year when I was arriving at my hotel in Geneva for the eighth year in a row, I recognized the people hanging out in the lobby from the year before as if they had never left the building, and on my way upstairs, I thought, yeah, that's kind of an interesting idea for a book. What about a guy who gets trapped in a hotel for a long period of time? And in my hotel room, I took out the hotel stationery and began sketching the outline for the story. And right off the bat, I kind of knew if I was going to take my protagonist and trap him in a hotel for 30 years, then he shouldn't be there by preference. He should be there by force. And that just made me think of Russia for all the reasons you might imagine. You know, and so I mean, I've been a fan of Russian culture since I was a teenager because of reading the Russian novels from the 19th century, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, short stories, mm-hmm. Chekhov. And so eventually I've grown to really be fascinated by Russian culture throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. And so it just seemed like the perfect setting for a story. If you're going to trap someone in a hotel, do it in a country where there's a lot of turmoil outside the hotel, and where there's, you know, a history of a rapid transition from sort of a refined aristocracy to a sort of a new modern era under the communists.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed the uniqueness of the setting and the Hotel Metropole. Have you stayed there? I know it is a standing structure, right?
It is. Hotel? Yeah, it was opened in 1905, and you know, at the time it opened, it was the best hotel in Moscow. It was the best hotel in Russia. And if any American had visited that hotel through most of the 20th century, they would have recognized it in a sense because it was very much like the grand hotels that you would find in Paris or along the Mediterranean or in San Francisco, you know, the Palace in San Francisco or the Waldorf in New York. All those hotels were kind of built in the same way to serve the same purpose. So in a way, it's kind of an international space, if you will. It's not like it's a uniquely Russian environment. But so the hotel does exist. It was built, and what ended up happening over its history is that it's had, right after the Russian Revolution, it was taken over by the Bolsheviks and turned into a government building. But then it was reopened to foreigners and kind of became an oasis of glamour and liberty inside the Soviet era, despite the fact that it was across the street from the Kremlin and around the corner from the headquarters of the secret police. But to answer your first question, when I decided to write the story and back in 2009, and I had decided I was going to set it in the Metropole, I decided I would go live in the hotel for a week, but I would only do that once the first draft of the book was finished. And, you know, it seems like an odd, for people who don't write, that may seem like an odd instinct. But in the realm of trying to create a convincing and engaging narrative in the form of a novel, it can be helpful to push back reality for a minute and imagine the set of circumstances as fully as you can before you let sort of reality start to creep in. And so, yeah, that's what I did. I wrote the first draft, and then I flew to Moscow and spent a week in the hotel touring it, you know, in its intricacies and sort of beginning to rethink what, if anything, I would change in the story.
Awesome. And was that 2011, 2012?
Yeah, well, the book came out it was over that sort of time frame. The book came out in 2016, so this would be in 2014. It was probably when I first went to the hotel.
Okay. Wow. So as a writer, your process of writing, you do your first draft, you visit the hotel. Did it affect that much, or did the gist of it stay the same?
Yeah, to give you a feel for that, first of all, I'm an outliner, so I will think about a book for a year to 2 years before I start writing chapter one, and in the course of that 2 years, I will outline every chapter, every event, all the characters and their backgrounds, all the settings, all the key elements kind of laid out in chapter by chapter. And then when I write the book, it might take me a year and a half to do the first draft, but then I will revise the book from beginning to end three times usually, and that takes me about another 2 to 3 years. So the whole thing, is a four to five-year process for me. But absolutely, draft two and draft three have material changes from draft one. It's not just tinkering with verbs. You're kind of using the first draft to sort of figure out what's not right in this story, and where is it boring? What doesn't make sense? What isn't fully realized? Yeah. What character hasn't really been given his or her due? And that's a big part of the second draft for me. Often is kind of beginning to shorten up the central characters by editing down sort of unnecessary parts, which frees up sort of time and space to let smaller characters come to greater fruition. And so, as you know from reading the book, Andrew, that most of the book, 95% of it, is sort of following closely the Count's experiences, but occasionally at the end of chapters, you kind of follow one of the other characters, one of the other people who work in the hotel, back to their apartment or into the countryside or wherever it is they're going. And those little bits, for instance, were largely written in draft two, where I kind of said I wanted to know, what does Andre, the maitre d', at the end of the Second World War, what does he feel like when he goes home and to cook dinner for his wife when their son has been killed in the war, or when what does Anna Urbanova, the temperamental actress, who gets in an argument with the Count, what does she think when she goes back to Leningrad, in fury and, about this engagement with this, in her opinion, haughty sort of ex-aristocrat. So the lingering questions about these characters, I sort of felt like, there's a place for that in the story. So I started to weave those moments into the book of where you leave the hotel and see those characters in a little bit more detail. But there's certainly some things about the hotel that started to influence me. When I was in the hotel in Moscow, I brought with me firsthand accounts of what happened in the hotel in the 1920s and 30s and 40s by famous Americans. So John Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath, he stayed at the hotel and wrote about it. E. Cummings, the American poet, wrote about it. Lillian Hellman, the American playwright, wrote about it. So I took these first-hand accounts and kind of was going through them, and Steinbeck is the one who he talks about staying at the hotel and at a point in, I guess it's the early 50s at this point, where when you order your dinner in the restaurant, the waiter takes down what you order and has to go to the front of the restaurant where there's, in essence, a clerk who reviews the order, makes a copy of it, stamps it, and then you're allowed to take the stamped order into the kitchen. The chef then reviews it, makes a copy, and stamps it, and so this happens like five times.
It sounds familiar.
So there's this really intricate process of all this paperwork and all these people involved, and so in the second or third draft I was like, I'm gonna incorporate that into the story. So yes, the Count at some point becomes a waiter in the hotel's fine restaurant because he's got kind of nothing better to do, and given his upbringing as an aristocrat, it's sort of the perfect environment for him. And yes, eventually the bureaucratic communist government fills that restaurant with paperwork. And, you kind of pluck that out of reality and weave it back into the imagined tale.
Yes, awesome. That's cool. I loved the sort of surprise turns. And you just talked about, I guess, the inspiration behind them. When you would follow another character home or out and about in Russia. And it does seem, and I had a... I had a former teammate come over who was a Russian history major and give me an hour and a half lecture about modern Russian history after I read the book and after I talked to you. So at least I could hold my chops a bit. And he read the book as well and really, really liked it and had an interesting insight. He thought that the hotel was a metaphor for how the Russian people, through this time, these decades of upheaval and purges and uncertainty, that to cope you focused on your local community and your home and your people and did you was that also an inspiration for having the hotel be
setting? That's an excellent observation on
I can't take credit for it myself. Yeah. I wish I could take credit for it myself.
You would have gotten away with it probably, but there's a long history in Russia, even from Tsarist times, but certainly during the communist era, of as sort of various strictures were put in place and rules were put in place, as the risk of arrest became more serious and dangerous, citizens sort of, as you say, they began to pursue their lives in sort of intimate, secret, at times secret ways, but on a smaller scale. You know, I like to remind people, I'm 53. Anybody in my generation was raised to picture the Soviet era really as one of, you know, hardships, breadlines, artistic repression, fear of arrest, possibility of execution, all of which played a role in Soviet history. But for many Americans raised in the Cold War, we forget that Russians continue to fall in love, get married, have children, you know, celebrate feasts with their families, love literature, love music, continue to hope for the best for their children and dream for their children, have fond memories of their childhood. You know, the richness of human life that we experience and, you know, in the luxury of freedom in America was absolutely a part of the Russian experience in the Soviet era. But as you say, with these kinds of strictures that forced you to do those, to fully realize those in different ways. So you had, of course, even though religion was outlawed, it was a very religious population, very often celebrating religion quietly or in secret. And if you were an artist, you might write one play for the state, in essence, and write a different play that you would perform with your friends, taking a certain risk in doing so. If you were concerned that your house was bugged, old friends would meet at 2 a.m. and turn on the radio and talk honestly over the kitchen table. But there were sort of these ways that you kind of adapted, and the hotel is a giant version of that. You're absolutely right. You know, where there's kind of this little oasis where people can pursue aspects of their life that are harder to pursue out in the broader landscape of the Soviet era.
Yeah, a giant, colorful version of that life. And one of the major themes, I think, and you spell this out quite literally at a couple times, is the Count, Alexander Rostov, who's been put on house arrest by the Cheka, the sort of secret tribunal police government or judiciary system, and his sort of battle with not allowing his circumstances to master his life and his happiness and how he goes about things. And I find it quite uplifting.
Thank you.
As well, to see that. And you talked about this earlier briefly, and I think I read an article where you talked about this as well, but you find it much easier to write about subjects and periods, and maybe easy is the wrong word, but that interest you and that you have some degree of knowledge in. And it sounds like as a kid you really enjoyed reading the sort of Russian classics, the 19th century literature.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, many people will say to me, you know, how did you research this, or what's your? It must be a very long-tailed research process. And that's, as you say, that's not the way I work. What I'll tend to do is say, what's a story that I can tell that draws on an existing fascination? And so my first novel, Rules of Civility, is set in New York in 1938. And I was a fan of the 1920s and 30s as a kid. You know, I watched the movies, I read the novels, I listened to the music, and so I invented that, my version of New York 1938, out of that long-standing fandom, as it were. And this is a similar thing. After that, many years, you know, decades of reading Russian literature and eventually about Russian life and art, I use that as the foundation to invent here. And I different novelists have different approaches to their material. There's some of the great writers I think about Raymond Carver or John Updike, who really like to draw on their personal experience as the material for their invention. You know, Raymond Carver wrote these amazing short stories about, you know, the life of lower middle class, you know, husband and wife. You know, one has just lost their job. They're drinking vodka out of paper cups, you know, or at the linoleum table, and it's a real aspect of American life. But that was absolutely the life that he basically lived for decades. And I'm kind of the other kind of writer who's interested in exploring things that I have not experienced. That's the attraction for me. And I will take this area of fascination, like New York in the 30s or like the Soviet era, and use that as an opportunity to imagine something as fully as I can.
Awesome. So it sounds like we won't get an investment banking book.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, do not hold your breath for that. That'll be the last thing I ever do. That's right.
And I find that fascinating because there is another author, T.A. Barron, who writes some amazing younger reader fiction books, including a series on a young Merlin, who was also very, very successful in the financial world, retired from that and wrote books and followed his passion. And what was that like? How many years did you sort of step away from writing, and when did it feel right to go back to it, or did you always want to go back?
When I was 25 and had been writing at that point for a decade, and it was clearly what I wanted to do with my life. It was my passion. I joined a friend who had started an investment firm, and for the next decade, I stopped writing as I was helping him and my colleagues get that business off the ground. But as I was going through that, I kind of knew if I did not eventually get back to writing fiction, I would probably end up quite a bitter and a drinker as an old man.
Yeah.
So I at the age of 35, I said, all right, I got to turn my attention back to this, and in my spare time, start writing fiction. And I spent 7 years writing a novel that I didn't like. Set that aside.
Okay. 7 years.
That was painful. But I learned a great deal from that, and I used the lessons from that process to write Rules of Civility. And then when that became a bestseller, I retired from the firm to sort of pursue this passion full time, and which is a great pleasure. I loved my old job. It was great fun. I had great colleagues and clients. We had a great practice. The best thing that my job did for me as an artist was really in that by the time I sat down to write Rules of Civility, I wasn't doing it for money. I wasn't doing it to impress my friends or my parents. I wasn't doing it in competition with my peers. I just was doing it for myself. And that's that's a real luxury as an artist. You know, at the age of 26, if you're in New York and you're married and you're trying to make it as an author, that's a lot of pressure that's putting on your invention. And you may make choices that are the wrong choices in the hopes of getting a big advance or impressing your friends or what have you. And so doing it later in life, that was the one advantage to me. Is it really got to do it just for my own creative interests, and I think that was that made it a better book.
Absolutely, that sounds like it certainly has affected you in a very positive way. And I think in The Gentleman in Moscow, I sense the joy that you get in writing come out off the pages. I'm not sure how to quite explain that, but it feels like you love to write, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I thank you, because I do. Now, sir, are you going to have post NFL that you may experience? Are you going to write? Are you going to start?
Reading is the passion. Not so much. But on the subject of reading, you mentioned fiction, sort of Russian 19th century. What else did you read as a kid? You mentioned the 20s and 30s in New York.
Yeah, right.
Any other eras or subjects that really fascinated you?
I think like many writers, not all, but like many, writing and reading for me was a simultaneous process. I mean, around the time I began to write, I began to write, and then I did them side by side. So in the course of my life, at the age of 53, I've had many fascinations and influences where, I would spend an extended period of time reading the works of Joseph Conrad, you know, which are such great adventures and so beautifully written, or reading Edith Wharton and Henry James and the kind of the society sort of literature of their work. I've, you know, certainly read Hemingway and Fitzgerald, but William Faulkner and his, you know, incredible explorations, inventive explorations of life in the South. And I love the magical realists like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And so over time, kind of delving into another author and sort of trying to learn how do they approach the art, how do they bring various themes to light, how do they create different voices, and then I would sort of start to practice in a way with that in my own writing. You know, you leave reading one person and say, oh man, that was so cool, how can I want to try that thing that they're doing. And and so yeah, it's kind of an ongoing process for me.
Awesome. And so while you were writing A Gentleman in Moscow, you were concurrently reading fiction then?
Yeah, and I try to be careful when I'm, although I must admit, in preparation for writing Gentleman in Moscow, I spent a few years going back and rereading the great Russian writers and reading them more deeply than I had in the past. So instead of reading just the two, you know, famous Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment and Brothers Karamazov, I read three others. I read The Idiot. I read, you know, his other books. I did the same thing with Tolstoy. I had not read Gogol deeply, and I went back and reread him. I read Chekhov again, and that was great fun, kind of to do sort of in the years leading up to writing my book, as to kind of sort of immerse myself in a sort of Russian sensibility. Once I started writing, I stopped that cold turkey, in essence, because you don't. If I keep reading them while I'm writing, then I'm going to, you know, start writing like they write, you know, which is disastrous. So, particularly in the first draft, I will kind of push back any influence. I'll be very careful because I don't want that.
Let your own voice come out.
Yeah, that's right, because that's the hardest part and the most important part of the job, in a way, is to find that voice that's natural to the story, and you don't want to have a crowded room while you're trying to figure out what that voice is.
Well, certainly. And a couple more questions before we finish up. But do you have a recommendation for a younger reader, and then maybe one other recommendation for an adult on a book that you really enjoyed or are enjoying? It can't be your own book, so.
Yeah, I know. I understand. Hopefully that would be evident to most authors. I'll start with the younger adult book, but I feel a little. I feel foolish making this recommendation because the younger adult world probably was making this recommendation to me. You know what I mean? Because I just, at the encouragement of a friend, finished Ready Player One, which you know the probably teenagers across America discovered before their parents. But it's a great fun book for you know, if you're a teenager who has not read it, it's a terrific adventure. So this mix between The Matrix and Harry Potter, and you know, sort of this world that you get to see through a teenager's eyes, and it's a little dystopian, of course, and you know, as so many youthful books are right now. Yeah. But nonetheless, it was very engaging, entertaining read. I thought and struck some great notes in the sort of young adult.
Well, I will confess, I'm a 28-year-old and have not read it. So
okay. Yeah, if you've got any interest in the video game world, then it's a must. But I guess the other reason to read it now is Steven Spielberg's making it into a movie, and so it is worth reading it before that all happens. You know, once his vision enters the popular culture, it'll be fun to have read it yourself before we see how Spielberg imagines it. But I think, you know, for adults, I read, as I kind of implied a minute ago, I read in projects. I actually read with three friends. The three of us have been reading together for 14 years. We read a novel a month. And it's two men, two women. We you know, go to a restaurant at 7 o'clock at night. We close the place to talk about a novel every month. But we will read in projects. So this year, and I, you know, this has been it's fun. I would recommend it to any reader of who enjoys serious American narrative. We started reading Toni Morrison from the beginning. And, you know, she's one of the few Americans who've, you know, won the Nobel Prize in Literature. She's obviously a great, you know, giant, but to go back and read The Bluest Eye and Sula and Beloved kind of in the sequence that she wrote them is she's like an extraordinary American voice, and sort of to capture sort of these moments, particularly obviously in the African American experience in America. But they're beautiful, beautiful novels. So that's a lot of fun.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I hope some folks maybe pick up a book they otherwise might not have after listening to this. And thank you very much, Mr. Amor Towles. A Gentleman in Moscow was a true delight. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Anytime, Andrew.
The rest of 2018.
Thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Then that was another Andrew Luck Book Club podcast. See you next time.